The shuttered Columbia Falls aluminum plant may end up as a Superfund site. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine, and Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about federal funding for flood disaster aid in Montana, and in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with the founder of an organization that helps victims of modern-day slavery stay free and economically independent. The Columbia Falls aluminum plant is eligible for Superfund designation. Whether that will happen remains to be seen. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on the results of the Environmental Protection Agency's recent report on the shuttered facility.
The current owner of the Columbia Falls aluminum plant, Glencore, closed the doors to the facility in 2009, citing low aluminum costs and high electricity costs. Despite efforts to negotiate lower energy costs, the plant has not reopened. The Environmental Protection Agency did the site reassessment after requests from Senators John Tester and Max Baucus last year. Site assessment manager Rob Parker with the EPA says the last assessment was done in the late 1980s. At the time, the plant was still in operation and had just stopped storing spent potliners in the on-site landfill. Parker says this most recent assessment was for screening. They looked at the landfill, percolation ponds, and sludge pond, not at all potential sources of contamination.
And that's one of the outcomes of this site assessment was that we determined that there is contamination present at the site itself as well as in nearby areas. And we feel that more investigation is warranted at this site.
The Flathead River flows south from the plant, and Parker says cyanide and fluoride were found in the groundwater at the site and downstream in the river. The EPA also tested nearby residential wells and found cyanide.
And I should be clear that the detections of cyanide were below EPA's maximum contaminant levels, which are the regulatory levels that EPA sets for municipal drinking water supply under the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Further residential well samples were gathered last week. Parker says they will study these samples to determine human health risks.
And then if it's determined that there are human health risks, then the next step in the program would be to go forth and do that remediation to essentially ensure that folks aren't being exposed to any increased risk.
Parker says the site is eligible to be put on the national priorities list. This would designate the plant as a Superfund site. Parker says the EPA makes the decision, but works with the state and local community to ensure support for such a designation. The EPA recently hosted a public meeting to talk about the report results and open up a dialogue between the city and the agency.
We want, you know, folks to know that we're receptive to ideas and that we want, you know, their input is invaluable. You know, they're the folks who live on the ground there and understand more than we do, you know, what the potential concerns can be.
After designation would come what Parker calls the remedial investigation, identifying as many sources of contamination as possible and determining long and short-term human health risks. It forms a blueprint for how cleanup would take place.
To really get a good baseline assessment of what areas need to be prioritized for cleanup, what areas aren't necessarily needed for cleanup, which can certainly play into a decision to redevelop the property as well.
The decision would get made in the fall.
If the site would be designated on the national priorities list, EPA would be able to go back in time and look at not only the current operator but previous operators that may have caused or contributed to any contamination on site.
Parker says between now and the fall, EPA will be reaching out to past and current owners to involve them in the cleanup process. The plant began operating in the 1950s under the Anaconda Company. It has since been owned by the Atlantic Richfield Company and a group of investors before being purchased by Glencore in 1999. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
And in other news from around the state, the president has signed a disaster declaration for Montana over damage caused by widespread flooding and ice jams early last month. President Barack Obama signed the declaration today that makes federal funding available on a cost-sharing basis to state and eligible local governments and some private nonprofit organizations for repair or replacement of facilities damaged by recent flooding. The counties affected are Broadwater, Dawson, Golden Valley, Jefferson, Lake, Musselshell, Park, Ponderay, Prairie, Ravalli, Richland, Rosebud, Sanders, Stillwater, and Wheatland County. The declaration also makes federal funding available on a cost-sharing basis for hazard mitigation measures statewide. The Federal Emergency Management Agency said additional designations may be made at a later date if requested by the state and warranted by the results of further damage assessments.
The Montana Supreme Court has rejected an attempt by opponents of Medicaid expansion to rewrite a language of the proposed ballot initiative. Attorney General Tim Fox had agreed with initiative opponents who said the measure's estimated costs were misleading as presented. Fox and the plaintiffs sought a court order to revise the fiscal statement and void all existing signed petitions. The court's 6-0 decision today said there is no clear and mistakable error in the fiscal statement, and delaying signature gathering for court proceedings would amount to a ruling for the plaintiffs. Sponsors have until June 20th to gather 24,175 voter signatures to place Initiative 70 on November's ballot. The justices say the plaintiffs can still file legal challenges if the measure makes it to the ballot or becomes law.
Governor Steve Bullock is proposing a $45 million grant program to ease strains on basic services faced by towns in eastern Montana's fast-growing Bakken oil patch. The proposal will need approval from the legislature. Bullock last year vetoed a measure that would have created a fund for infrastructure improvements in the Bakken region. The Democratic governor said in a statement today that the oil boom has brought jobs and opportunity, but also challenges for local communities. Tens of thousands of workers have been drawn to the region in the past several years. Most drilling is occurring in neighboring North Dakota, yet the pressures from a growing population spill across the border with added demands on school systems, wastewater treatment plants, law enforcement, and other basic services.
It's something of a mixed bag for Missoula's housing market. An annual report compiled by the Missoula Organization of Realtors finds generally encouraging news marred by a few key areas of concern. The Trade Association's 2014 Missoula Housing Report finds a market continuing to rebound from the depths of the recession years, but that growth is tempered by a decrease in affordability. The number of residential lot sales increased to 67 from 36 3 years ago. For the third year in a row, average lot prices increased to $75,000. Missoula's rental vacancies remain below the national average in all categories, but new housing continues to arrive on the market, increasing vacancies across the board. Rental prices didn't move much in the past year. Professional Property Management's Tom Chapman says some rental property owners are now more willing to negotiate move-in bonuses or offer a month's free rent to attract tenants.
In other words, you've got those vacancies, you've got to fill them. Are you going to lower the rent? Or are you going to find a way to attract renters without lowering that rent? And so that's where they're using those incentives. So I think that there is a lot of good deals out there for renters. There's the opportunity to negotiate and get some bonuses in there to get you a little better deal than what these rental rates actually reflect.
The local public housing agency offers 774 Section 8 housing vouchers available to subsidize rent to private landlords for eligible participants. The Montana Department of Commerce provides another 262 vouchers. But the Missoula Housing Attorney's Jim McGrath says funding cuts means not all of those vouchers could be offered. As a result, 40 fewer families could be served last year. The voucher waiting list continues to rise. McGrath says sporadic federal funding makes it next to impossible to provide quality and predictable service.
It's not a good service to our clients. It's not a good service to our partners, landlords, and property owners that work with us. It's not a good service to you, the citizens of Missoula, who want to see this program in place. And while I would probably advocate for consistent high funding so that we can serve as many people as possible, I think you can make a pretty good case anyway that consistent funding has its advantages rather than these sort of radical mood swings.
Home sales increased by 23% in 2013, 1,322 compared to 1,068 in 2012. Sales were strongest in the $150,000 to $275,000 price range. Prudential Missoula Real Estate's Colin Bangs points out affordability continues to be a challenge in Missoula. Because most Missoulians can't afford to put 20% down on a house, they must pay mortgage insurance.
You pay mortgage insurance, that raises your payment. That means you can actually afford less of a house for that payment. So the other two factors are, as we've seen, is the cost of housing went up again. The price went up again. And as the prices climb and incomes don't follow suit, then there's fewer and fewer people who can afford the median-priced house. The third factor is the interest rate. Interest rates jump by 1%. When you're starting at 3%, 1% is almost a 30% increase in interest you're paying every month. That really did affect affordability fairly dramatically.
He also pointed out that local incomes have dropped in the past year. The 2014 Missoula Housing Report also notes the number of homeless and at-risk children has increased over 30% in the last couple of years.
The files of about 200 clients of the Valley Veterans Service Center in Hamilton have been returned to the center. The center was closed for about 2 weeks in March after veterans complained that former claims agent Dan Rochelle had become verbally abusive and had threatened the president. Rochelle told the River Valley Republic the Veterans Administration advised him to remove the files to protect client privacy. The files contained medical records and other information the veterans submitted to apply for benefits. Rochelle resigned after being charged. Veterans Center Board Chairman Bill Jetty says the files were returned Monday by a law enforcement officer. Jetty says employees are going through the files to make sure nothing is missing. He says all but five files taken from the office were returned.
A 72-year-old resident of a Butte-assisted living facility has denied charges that he stabbed another resident to death last month. The Montana Standard reports 72-year-old John Edwards Grubbs Sr. pleaded not guilty today to felony deliberate homicide. His public defenders say they plan to question Grubbs' competency to stand trial in the death of 72-year-old Jerry Diltz. Charging documents say the two men had been drinking together at the facility early on March 19th when they began to argue about money. Prosecutors allege Grubbs repeatedly stabbed Diltz with a large butcher knife. Grubbs remains jailed and with bail set $250,000.
Montana state prison officials say an inmate has died of an apparent hanging at a Colorado prison. Prison spokeswoman Linda Moudry says 38-year-old Timothy De Herrera was found unresponsive in his cell late Saturday afternoon. He was hanging with a sheet that was tied to a cell window. De Herrera's death is under investigation. De Herrera was first sentenced to prison in April 2004 for two auto thefts and assault on a peace officer in Yellowstone County. At the time of his February 2003 arrest, the Colorado Springs man was suspected of stealing a minivan in Colorado Springs and a pickup truck in Wheatland, Wyoming. He was sentenced in September 2008 for riot and criminal mischief and later moved to a Colorado prison. Moudry did not say where in Colorado De Herrera had been held.
A private corrections company that plans to turn a long-vacant southeastern Montana jail into a treatment center for Bureau of Indian Affairs inmates held a job fair to take applications for about 115 jobs. The Billings Gazette reports officials with Emerald Corrections Management of Lafayette, Louisiana, handed out 200 job applications within 2 hours of the start of yesterday's job fair in Hardin. Chief Operating Officer Steve Aifman has said Emerald is pursuing plans to house about 350 inmates at the Two Rivers Detention Facility for therapeutic treatment. No contracts have been signed. Emerald employee Doyle Jones says the company is looking to hire correctional officers, social workers, and health care providers, along with kitchen, clerical, and maintenance staff. Company officials say they hope to open the treatment center in June.
27 million people around the world, in every country, are being held in modern slavery. Many are women and young children living in despicable, inhumane conditions and exploited sexually, physically, and emotionally. This week, the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana has tried to shine a light on this slavery with a conference titled Fight for Hope and Freedom, Human Trafficking, Montana, and the World. Speakers who fight human trafficking and who work with survivors have come to the conference from many countries to join those in Montana who are fighting human trafficking within our borders. Sarah Simmons is the co-founder with her husband, John Berger, of the organizations known as Made by Survivors, which works to provide survivors of slavery in countries like India, Nepal, and Cambodia education, training, and jobs that can help them stay free and economically independent. Before starting the organization, Simmons was a composer of music for television and film. In this feature interview, Simmons tells news director Sally Mock her life and career changed when she saw the documentary The Day My God Died about human trafficking.
And initially, I really didn't want to go see it. Was very apprehensive that it would be too upsetting or that I wouldn't be able to do anything about it. And I think this issue is a painful one and one that a lot of people are a little bit afraid of at first. But when I saw the movie, I was actually very empowered by it because as upsetting as it was, it also showed people all over the world who were taking action against trafficking and very successfully. And it's an issue that, you know, really responds well when people start taking action against it and start intervening. And some of the people in the movie were the survivors. They were so courageous, you know, after all the trauma they'd experienced, to be going back and rescuing others and doing this prevention work. So I felt, you know, if they can do it, I can find a way to do it as well.
Let's talk a little bit about some of that trauma. I think it is so horrendous, but it's important that we know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all kinds of what can only be called slavery and bondage of human beings.
I really think it's one of the most severe and egregious human rights abuses and crises in the world today. You know, for there to actually be people who have no control over any aspect of their life, their body, their sexuality, what they eat, you know, when they take a shower, their children's lives, you know, to just lose.
And many of them are children. I mean,
many of them are children. In a lot of cases, you know, if someone is trafficked for into a brothel situation, the traffickers will ensure that she, the child of 13 or 14, has a baby within the first couple of years, because once you have a baby, you don't even need a lock on the door or chains because the mother won't leave the baby. So they're even using, you know, our natural bonds of love against us in that way. So it is, you know, it is truly an inhumane thing and very, very devastating to physical health and to emotional and spiritual health as well.
And can be lifelong. Some of these children, they're slaves their entire life.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a group I work with in northern India where you literally have generations of a family. They're in a type of slavery called bonded labor that's also called debt bondage, where maybe a debt was owed 20, 30 years ago of $37 or $40. And the family was made to believe, you know, exploited and threatened and made to believe that they had to work off that debt. But the debt only accumulated because really it was a form of slavery. And if they were tricked, and often an entire village will be exploited in this way. And you literally have people that have grown up in slavery. Now, for a child that grows up in slavery, even if the slavery situation ends and, you know, they're no longer in that situation, but if they haven't had any education, even the most basic life skills, because they've been in slavery, the chances of them being, you know, free and empowered are nil, because you really have to make sure that a person has that kind of basics. And that's how slavery, you know, generation to generation to generation just continues. And so it's just very important to kind of like break that cycle.
Right. It's not a question of just rescuing them and getting them out of the situation. They've got to have something to go to. And that's where your group really came
forward. That is absolutely our focus. Yes. And because when I got into this, I, you know, was devastated that it was happening, was even more devastated to find out that so many people after rescue were being trafficked again and again, or they were falling back of their own accord back into a really desperately exploitative situation, like going back to sex work voluntarily because they did not have these basic skills. The situations that caused them to be trafficked, being impoverished, having no opportunities,
no
gender discrimination, no education, if those things weren't addressed and they weren't being adequately addressed, people were getting trafficked again and again. So while rescue is absolutely crucial first step on your journey to freedom, it's very far from the last. In order for you to really be free, in my opinion, to be free forever, you've got to be, you know, safe from being trafficked again. You can't be skating right on the edge of it and living in constant fear and vulnerability. So what we're all about is giving people the tools, whether it's education for younger children or job training and employment for adults, as well as safe housing for all, to give them the tools that allows them to really get out of that vulnerability and remain free forever.
You've said, quote, the final goal is to get them slavery proofed.
That's right, slavery proofed. And they got to know their human rights. They've got to know that slavery is illegal. A lot of people are trafficked. They think, I have to do this. My parents sent me here. I have to do this. We owe $37. Whatever it is, helping them understand this is illegal. This is, you know, absolutely unethical. You don't have to do it. You can, you know, no one can make you. You can walk away. Because, like I say, the cases of people actually being under lock and key and chained, that's usually only at the very beginning. You don't need that after a while because people, you know, they come to accept it. They know that they can't go home because there's so much stigma surrounding it. You know, so them to be slavery proof, they got to have their human rights. And then they've got to have a really good economic alternative, not one that keeps them at the poverty level, but a good one that allows them to advance the society and overcome the tremendous stigma.
Your organization, Made by Survivors, the title is to be taken literally because the survivors that you work with are, I think, mostly women, and they make jewelry, and that jewelry is sold, and that gives them a living.
Absolutely. They make gorgeous silver jewelry.
You're wearing some of it, I see.
I am.
I love that necklace. Tell me about the necklace.
I'm wearing the Freebird necklace. It's a sterling silver necklace, and it has a dove in front of it that kind of hangs loosely in front of it. And the girls often have chosen birds as a symbol, you know, for freedom, and not necessarily just in relationship to slavery, but also in terms of being women in a society that doesn't always honor that. And seeing a bird is, you know, can just have its own journey and fly away. So we have a lot of jewelry with birds, and our women are they're really pioneers. This industry is been totally dominated by men. They're some of the first women in India and Nepal to be goldsmiths. And so they take a lot of pride in that, and they should. It takes a long time to learn. It takes several years to develop even, you know, kind of the basic level, and then it's a lifelong learning thing. So all of our programs we try to also have a culture of lifelong learning, because you find that, you know, by developing the individual, it continues to help them to address the trauma that we talked about earlier.
Your organization, I understand, has really helped hundreds of women. There are millions that need help. That's such a daunting figure, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. And I think that, you know, two answers to that. One is we need more people involved. You know, we need conferences like this, and then we need people who've come to this conference or heard about this to then say, what am I going to do and who can I go help? I guarantee you.
There are many ways to plug in.
There's so many ways to plug in. And for everyone that's listening and everyone that came to the conference, there's people out there that you can save their life, and you can give them the tools to save their own life. And there's someone out there that if you don't help, they won't be helped. It's really on all of us. And we need more people to get involved if we're going to really address the issue of the millions. And the other thing is that I'm trying to create my girls to be the change makers, you know, these survivors. I won't be here, you know, in 50 years. They will. And if we can empower them to change a community from within, and if that happens in different places around the world through different organizations working together, I think that we can end this, you know, by empowering them.
You're a modern-day abolitionist, Sarah.
Absolutely. I'm proud to be one.
We have been speaking with Sarah Simmons, who's founder of the organization called Made by Survivors, which works with survivors of human trafficking, of modern-day slavery, to get them on their economic feet and help them survive beyond being rescued. And Sarah, great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if people wanted to learn more, they should go to my website, madebysurvivors.com. Thank you so much, Sally, for having me.
Once again, for more information about human trafficking and about Simmons' organization, go to madebysurvivors.com.
And now for tonight's forecast, West of Divide. There is a lake wind advisory in effect from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. tomorrow for the Flathead and Mission Valleys. Tonight, rain is likely with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and highs in the upper 40s to mid-50s. For central Montana, there is a wind watch in effect from tomorrow afternoon through evening for the Rocky Mountain Front and Eastern Glacier. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and lows 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain with a chance of snow in the afternoon. Highs are in the 50s, and wind gusts could reach up to 50 miles per hour in the afternoon. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain in the evening with lows in the 30s, and tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the 50s.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 61 degrees with sunny conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 50 degrees. Butte has 55 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Great Falls is cloudy with 59. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 56 degrees. It's 62 and cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 61 degrees. Libby has 47 degrees with mostly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, it's raining and it's 51 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dave Ditloff.
Thank you. The International Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, released another report this past Sunday. Written by thousands of science, policy, and economic experts, this IPCC report, along with others that have been released in the last year, represent a synthesis of existing climate research. The findings in the report are alarming. And while the report is very detailed in its research, the results can be summarized rather easily with four main points. 1. The climate is changing. 2. Carbon pollution is almost certainly responsible for the change. 3. The environmental, social, and economic costs of the changing climate almost assuredly will be substantial, unless we act quickly to substantially reduce carbon pollution. And 4. The economic costs of switching from a high-carbon, fossil fuels-based economy to a low-carbon one are relatively small. Let's take a look at each one of these points a little more closely. The first one, that the climate is changing, is pretty obvious. All we have to do is look out the window and read the news to notice that something is different than when we were younger. The IPCC report provides the science that backs up this obvious anecdotal evidence. According to the IPCC reports, global land and ocean surface temperatures show a warming of 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit over the period between 1880 and 2012. In the Northern Hemisphere, the span between 1983 and 2012 was likely the warmest 30-year period of any of the last 1,400 years. The reports also outline that extreme weather events like heat waves, droughts, and floods are also on the rise. The IPCC reports are strong in their language regarding point two, that carbon pollution is causing the changes in the climate. The report states that, quote, "It is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming," unquote. Putting a number to that statement, the report says that there is a 95% probability that man-made emissions, rather than natural variations, are the main cause of the warming. These first two findings aren't that different than previous versions of the IPCC reports. It is with point three that we need to act quickly to avert serious consequences that the new IPCC reports take on a more urgent tone. The reports say that to avert the worst effects of climate change, sharp carbon emission cuts worldwide need to begin now, with a 40 to 70% reduction by mid-century. In other words, we can't wait to make changes, and the changes we make need to be significant. From a policy standpoint, these findings should weigh heavily in the government decisions now pending regarding the development of new dirty fossil fuel projects. New traditional coal-fired power plants and coal development projects like Southeast Montana's Otter Creek Mine, and developments that facilitate the transport of dirty oil, like the Keystone XL pipeline, clearly would be steps in the wrong direction, at the very time that we need to be making significant strides to reduce carbon. This leads to the fourth main point in the new IPCC reports, that we can make the changes needed to reduce our carbon footprint without undue economic burden. Without even taking into account the benefits, like cleaner air and less pollution, the IPCC reports show that the cost of switching to the kind of needed low-emissions world would reduce yearly global economic productivity by only 0.06%. Compare that with the dire environmental, social, and economic costs of doing nothing, and any sensible form of risk analysis shows that the world should quickly and drastically move away from dirty fossil fuels like coal and oil and invest in low-carbon alternatives that cut energy waste and promote renewable energy. The IPCC reports show that all this is possible. We simply need to galvanize the social and political will to do so. To this end, more than 75 sponsoring organizations and businesses will be hosting a series of simultaneous, quote-unquote, Montana Climate Solutions events on the afternoon of April 26th. Events will be held in Big Fork, Billings, Bozeman, Columbia Falls, Great Falls, Hamilton, Helena, Kalispell, Lame Deer, Missoula, Pablo, Red Lodge, and Whitefish. Each event will be a little different. Most will have engaging speakers, and all of them will have the opportunity for attendees to voice their opinions and help mobilize Montanans to advocate for climate solutions right here in the state and across the country and the globe. For more information about the Montana Climate Solutions event nearest you, please go to meic.org/events/climate. I hope you'll be able to attend one of them. Addressing the changing climate is one of the most important issues of our time. Solutions to the problem exist. But to get government decision makers to act on them, we need to join together and speak up now, before it's too late. This is Dave Ditloff, Regional Representative for the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks for listening.
Dave Ditloff is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.